1933 was an interesting year to be born in India. When Madhur Jaffrey was born in British Delhi, her grandmother wrote the Sanskrit word Om on her tongue with honey. She witnessed the eventual independence of India in 1947. She's credited with introducing the film directors James Ivory and Ishmael Merchant to each other, and she later appeared in a number of their epic films. She's also been called the Julia Child of Indian cooking. Madhur Jaffrey joins us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about the colorful, flavorful world she grew up in and to add a little welcome spice to our lives today. Madhur, it's great to have you back on Travel with Rick Steves.
Well, it's wonderful to be here.
Now, when we think of the Raj, what does that mean when we think of India during the Raj?
Well, that's the period when the British ruled India. And it has a romantic air about it because it's sort of promoted that way. And a lot of films that have been done, television series that have been done, various wonderful dramas of that period, they tend to make you think it was a very romantic period, but it wasn't, because Indians were being ruled by somebody else and we were rebelling. We started rebellions around 1857 and have been rebelling ever since. And we kept rebelling until we got our independence. Luckily for us, we had incredible leaders like Mahatma Gandhi and Nehru who believed in nonviolence. So we got our independence technically, nonviolently, as far as the government was concerned. So it was a great period for me to be born in. I was born during the Raj. That was my birth date, is during the Raj. And then in 1947, we were independent. And I remember going to see the flag, the Indian flag being raised, everybody wow. throwing their caps in the air, Nehru and Mountbatten jointly in whites, riding a horse carriage together, one going out, one coming in. It was a grand old time.
In whites, one leader going out, one leader coming in. That must have been incredible.
Incredible. And the energy and enthusiasm. I think there must have been several million people in this one place where the flag was being raised. And it is as if, you know, pent up emotions that we were storing, not for ourselves only, but our ancestors, were suddenly there saying, good grief, we did it. We did it.
Now, what was the relationship between Britain and India after that? Was it angry or was it, okay, we learned, we had that chapter, we're going to work together now in a more respectful way?
It's interesting. I think when the British gave us independence, they did two or three rather rotten things at the same time. They partitioned India, as mm-hmm. you know. So now we have Pakistan, and then eventually we had Pakistan and Bangladesh. And the line was cut by some, I don't know who drew the line, but it just went through villages and, you know, every other little place without really any thought.
We all love the English, but they draw lines in ways that cause problems 100 years later.
Absolutely.
It's amazing how coarsely they draw lines in some office in London.
Yeah, right.
I mean, even today, when you think of the trouble in Syria or the trouble in Iraq,
absolutely,
it goes back to those darn English lines.
Exactly. So we suffered greatly and we lost a million people as people rushed from one border to the other, you know.
Huge population swaps because this was basically, okay, we need a place for Muslims and we need a place for Hindus, right? So Pakistan, Muslim, India, Hindu, but it's more complicated.
It's much more complicated.
Today in India, there's major Muslim states.
Exactly. We have more Muslims than any other country other than Indonesia.
In India?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
You know,
you got challenges. You got challenges with British imperialism. You got challenges with Muslims and Hindus.
As you said when you started talking, is that when you come to India, you're not coming to a tidy place. You're coming to a very untidy place. And that is both the charm, the marvel, and everything else about India.
It's our delight to have Madhur Jaffrey as our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Among her lengthy list of credits, she's starred in a number of Merchant Ivory films since the 1960s and on several episodes of TV's Law & Order. Her memoir of childhood in India is called Climbing the Mango Trees, and her latest book on Indian food is called Curry Nation. On her website, Madhur includes recipes for salmon in a Bengali mustard sauce and her own version of a Pakistani dish she calls turkey chapali kebabs. Her website is madhur-jaffrey.com, M-A-D-H-U-R-J-A-F-F-R-E-Y.com. And when you think about India today and when you were a child, I think of it as a landmass as big as Europe and as diverse as Europe, with more people than Europe. Today it's a gangly, fragile democracy, I think you could say, with a huge sea of poor people, a massive middle class. I mean, a middle class of more than 100 million people.
More than the people that there are in this country is our middle class.
So in India,
400 million people are middle class.
You could say there's 500 million desperately poor people, but there's more middle class people in India than in the United States of America. Wow. And you're surrounded by all sorts of complicated neighbors.
Absolutely, who wish us not so well. So it's a hard country, but at the same time, it has such history. It has such such beauty.
And I love the scene in your book. You're talking about during your childhood climbing a mango tree in your grandfather's orchard and exploring the world of hot and sour. Take us there. I mean, because this is the wonderful side of history, an intimate side of history. Here's a person who has done all sorts of wonderful and interesting things, going back to a humble childhood, climbing a mango tree and learning about the wonders of life, surrounded by all this tumult.
Exactly. So every child in India grows up surrounded by all kinds of tumult. So we grew up in an orchard. And strangely enough, the orchard was something that came through the British as a reward from the British for having done something that helped the British anyway. So my grandfather had this property where he built his house. And as little kids, you know, you eat sweet things. Yeah. People say, what do Indians eat? Well, you start off by sweet things. Do you start out with spicy things? No, we can't eat spicy things when we're little kids. But we aspire to spicy things because we see grown-ups eating them. It's like wearing stockings and a girl says, oh, one day I'll wear stockings. One day I'll eat spicy food. That's what you're dreaming about. So we had all these lovely mango trees in our orchard. And the thing was to get them when they were raw. And when they're raw, they're sour. Yeah. They're wonderfully sour. So all my cousins and I, we would all climb these mango trees and we'd be on the branches like little birds with our penknives. And then the eldest would take down a big mango, a green mango, and he would peel it and give us little slices. And we all carried up with our salt, pepper. It had a little roasted cumin in it, a little chili powder. And then we would dip the sour mango in that crunchy mango and then eat it. It was so delicious. And it was really a sign of growing up.
So you
I've graduated. I'm up.
And your
up.
Older cousins were higher on the tree,
yes,
doing the lead
down.
Work. And they were sending you the beautiful mangoes and you were adventuring, really.
Exactly.
Oh. Talk about the cuisine of a child in Delhi. You were growing up in Delhi,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
Like you talked about the snack of wealth. What
yes.
is the snack of wealth?
Oh, that was something. It's still made today, but it's you don't know what it is. It's just called a snack of wealth. Daulat ki chaat, that was the name for it. And this woman who used to bring it on her head, she had a huge tray, brass tray on her head, in which she carried these cups. And the froth was coming right up to the top. If you imagine a cappuccino, it looked like a cappuccino, but cold. And you only got it in the winter. And I would say, how do you make it? She says, oh, my child, what can I tell you? It is made with the dew that comes from heaven. You know, stories like this, and it is, it does require dew from heaven. But it was an amazing snack made with milk that you then froth up. And it has to have a cold winter for it to get really cold outside. And then it has pistachios in it, and it has little almonds in it, and it has sugar in it. And it's all cold and frothed up. And you eat it with like a piece of bamboo that's cut into a kind of spoon. And you eat it with that. And the taste and the texture is like heavenly froth.
Whoa.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Now, that was in the days of the Raj. That was back in the 40s or something.
Yes.
Today, do little children in India have the same delights, or is their food just convenience store munchies?
Well, this lady certainly doesn't come around anymore.
Right.
I was told by a cousin, she says, I can make it in my blender now, she said.
Oh, it is not the same.
No. Exactly. I said, no, you're not having the snack of wealth. You are having some blenderized.
Blenderized snack of wealth. You know, I love in your book how you talked about at school, as a schoolgoer, you would share a lunch table with Hindus, Muslims, vegetarians, and carnivores. And then you would describe the intrigue of basically marveling at the lunches of your friends who came from different cultural backgrounds.
Well, this is the thing in India, that here if you go to school, all the kids probably know exactly the same food.
Yeah.
They know chicken nuggets, they know a sandwich, they know a ham sandwich, they know a peanut jelly sandwich. There's no difference between what the kids eat. But in India, every home cooks such different food that what the kids bring in is remarkably different from what you're bringing in. So I, as a Hindu girl, would bring in certain types of things. A girl from South India would bring other things. A Muslim girl would bring probably some meat or the other and lovely breads of a certain sort. A Jain girl would bring in vegetarian food like potatoes. Every girl brought in something different. So you were dying to try somebody else's because you were sick of your own.
So if you had a curiosity, you would look forward to lunch pail cuisine.
Absolutely.
In midday, you'd take a break, you'd
That's
sit down,
right.
you'd travel around glorious, diverse India
right.
by peeking into the lunch pails of the other girls.
And I still do that today. If you go to India today, I'm writing another vegetarian book. So I was going around South India. And everywhere I went to this place where chilies were drying. And there was a woman sorting the chilies. I said, what are you going to eat today for lunch? Open your lunchbox. Let me look inside. I still want to do that. Because it reveals a whole cuisine, a way of thinking of a particular group of people.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're peeking into the lunch pails of people who live far away, as we do every week on Travel with Rick Steves. Right now, we're speaking with Madhur Jaffrey. Her book is Climbing the Mango Tree, a memoir of her childhood in India. She's also written At Home with Madhur Jaffrey. Her website is madhur-jaffrey.com, madhur-jaffrey.com. In your book, you talk about how the Punjabis are like Texans.
They are. Everything has to be bigger.
Now, who are the Punjabis? Because that's a beautiful place to travel.
All right. So if you are aware of the map of India, as it is now, because now Pakistan has been split. Punjab used to be in the northwest.
Where the Sikhs live?
The Sikhs also live there.
Uh-huh.
Because they're also Punjabis.
Right.
The Punjabis who are not Sikhs and Punjabis who are Sikhs.
Okay.
And they all live in Punjab. Punjab was a huge, big state, a wheat-growing state of India. People think Indians eat rice, but we eat a lot of wheat, and this was a wheat-growing state. Unfortunately, when the British partitioned us, Punjab got partitioned. So half of Punjab is in Pakistan, and we have the other half of Punjab. But their food is glorious. It's a rich, hearty, almost peasanty. It's like Italian food in the sense that it's the best of it is peasanty. It's
salt of the earth, rustic food.
Rustic, right. Of the earth, like a good pasta or, it is very similar to Italian food.
And Punjabis are proud. They do things bigger and better.
They do, and they're bigger people, taller people, okay. Big turbans if they're Sikhs,
Yeah.
And they were a martial group. They rode horses. And now when the partition happened and a lot of them came to Delhi, no more horses to ride. So what do they ride? They took over the cab service. And they ride cabs.
And we have Sikh cabbies in the United States.
Yes, and we have them in India, too.
If you meet an Indian cabbie in the United States, he's probably a Sikh. That goes back to their heritage as
horsemen. Well, they're riders of
and
the
guards,
terrain.
And they're traditionally the guards in the palace?
Exactly.
All right. In your book, you talked about discovering K-rations one Christmas. And when I read about that, I thought, K-rations, what a humble thing. Military pre-packed meals, right? But you found that, and it opened you up to wonders well beyond India.
To you, it's just K-rations. And what happened was that they were suddenly, the war ended in 40, what?
World War II. It was 1945, so we had a lot of K-rations floating around.
So 45, the war ended.
Okay.
And suddenly, the war had also been in our part of the world. Japan had attacked, and so the war was everywhere.
And these K-rations have a long life.
The K-rations have endless life, it seems. So there was suddenly that and parachute silk were released.
Parachute silk and K-rations.
They were in all the markets. Everybody
and
was wearing
army blankets. Army blankets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So everybody was in India was wearing dresses made out of parachute silk because suddenly it was everywhere and cheap.
Parachute silk.
And then
chic.
There were the K-rations wrapped in this brown
paper. So what did you remember was in a K-ration?
So then we would get them for like 1 rupee, a whole package. And the joy of opening it up like gorgeous treasure. And then what is inside? So the cigarettes you gave to your older cousins. Then there were olives. Oh, my goodness, I'd never eaten an olive before until I ate that. There was fruit cocktail. Can you imagine? And
you
we only got
like
fresh fruit.
Delicacy.
What's fresh fruit? You can get fresh fruit anywhere.
Yeah. Oh, fresh fruit.
We had fresh mangoes, fresh banana. Fruit cocktail, all the fruit put together in a little can with a cherry, you know. It was fascinating for us. And Spam, my goodness. My cousins and I used to cut the Spam up into little pieces. We liked it so much, so it would last longer. Because these we'd never...
I've never heard anybody say, Spam, my goodness.
But we were totally charmed. These were the exotic things for us.
And that's just a wonderful thing about this planet, isn't it? I mean, Spam and fruit cocktail can be a delight. And a mango dipped in hot and sour spices can be a delight.
Yes, exactly.
Visiting with Madhur Jaffrey is like not wanting to get up from a really great meal. We'll continue with Madhur on her family life and eating in India in just a moment. By the way, thanks to our friends at Seattle Arts and Lectures for making Ms. Jaffrey available to us today. And we'll check in with friends from Italy on how they manage the chaos their country is famous for, and how we as visitors can better cope with things like rail strikes and crowds, or what they call everyday life in Italy. We'd love to hear about the impressions you get from your travels in the form of a haiku poem. There's a link for sending us your original haiku in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Here are some recent examples that our listeners have written that we thought you might enjoy.
Claire J. Baker of Pinole, California, sends us this poetic snapshot after a walk in a woodsy state park along the Russian River. Among redwood trees in Armstrong Grove, we look up and keep looking up. Roy Barnes from Cheyenne, Wyoming, writes this after a trip to Spain. La Alberca's pig, who bums around for morsels in the Spanish Square. Shelley De Leon of Astoria, Oregon, tells us how her visit to Spain could have been improved. Outside Alhambra is the one time I wanted some reservations. Cecilia Mazanek of Winter Park, Florida, paints a portrait of the view from El Montazo, a high spot in the Dominican Republic. Up above the world, puddles of colors below. If I could just jump! And Michael Venn emails us this haiku from his teaching position in Mokpo, South Korea. He adds he's been having some challenges communicating, both in and out of the classroom. How you're old, he asks. Wonder how sound I to him. Language gap is vast.
You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves.